You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, August 7th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Nexus audience.
Yes, we are live from Nexus 2021. This is the second full digital Nexus that we are doing. And George Robb, as you can hear, see, is our host. And everything's going pretty well, don't you think, Jay?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's the internet is an unpredictable beast. We had a speaker from Africa speaking to someone in Florida, and Kevin was in his backyard garden.
Yeah.
And we had a little bit of a delay, whatever. These things happen.
The fact that it worked at all, though, is amazing. But yeah, so there was some timing delay issues. So, Kara, you are on the West Coast, L.A., at the moment.
Yeah, so there may be a teeny tiny delay between what you say and what I say and then what you say again, because yeah, we're conferenced in, but it looks like I'm right next to you guys because we're all in this weird wooden room.
Is that weird?
That paneling.
You're in the boardroom, the Imagineering room.
The boardroom. I get it. That was an Evan joke right there.
Oh my God, Evan, sorry.
But in podcasting world, there are no delays because I edit out all of the delays. So you won't be hearing them. So every year, you know, we do, since we've been doing Nexus, we do a live SGU show at Nexus. And this is officially the Perry DeAngelis Memorial episode, where we remember our long lost rogue Perry DeAngelis. He was with us for, the longer the podcast goes on, it's amazing because he was with us for the first 2 years, just over 100 episodes. And now we're into years. We've completed 16 years. We're in our 17th year. It seems amazing that he was only part of the show for such a shrinking, fraction of it. And yet, he still is such a huge presence, I think, for the SGU, for the skeptical community, for us personally. Mm-hmm. And we also take this opportunity to remember some of our other friends of the SGU that we lost along the way. Mike Lassell, Mike Orticelli, David Young. These are people that were friends of the SGU. Mike actually worked, for the SGU for many years, and all lost prematurely, far, far, far too young.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot of skeptics who have died over the last 16 years who we've lost, but, these are the ones that were, directly involved with the SGU to some extent, and, again, we're just way, way too young when we lost them. All right, Bob, you're going to start us off with your numbers up.
Yes. So welcome to Bob, Your Numbers Up. Haven't done this in a little while. Today I'm going to talk about Google. That's G-O-O-G-O-L. Google is a number. It's 1 to the 100th power.
Yeah.
Right? It's 100. You get the drift there. It was coined in 1920 by a nine-year-old. His name was Milton Serrata. His uncle was a mathematician, and he wrote a book about mathematics and the imagination, and he put Google in there, and that kind of first brought it to the public's attention. Then, of course, Google, G-O-O-G-L-E, the Google company, kind of appropriated the word. Some people say that they misspelled it.
Bob, is that mathematical appropriation?
Yes, it is. It is. And
now we have something else to worry about.
And they spelled it wrong, which is like another slap to the face of the big number. But did they spell it wrong? I don't know. Some people say that it was actually a misspelling.
Probably not.
And they chose it because, they wanted to say that we handle so much information. But of course, Google is far greater than any type of information they could ever possibly handle. Google, the 1 to 100, there's other names for it, more legitimate, although they may be a little bit boring. There's 10 duo trigintillion is also 1 to 100. There's also 10,000 sextillion, but there's nothing boring about that number. That's actually one of my favorite numbers. Now, Google is not mathematically significant, really. It's really used in comparison for other numbers, so you can kind of get an idea. So, for example, Carl Sagan actually referenced Google or 1 to 100. Well, he actually compared it when he said that if you took all the elementary particles in the observable universe and counted them, there would be 10 to the 80 particles. So that just shows you that 10 to the 100 at Google is pretty damn big. It's a huge number. And here's another one. There's another one that I came up with today. And this was actually the most fun I had all day today, coming up with this calculation. If you filled the observable universe with Jay's meatballs, you would have 10 to the 90 meatballs. That's a lot. That's a lot of meatballs. But even that is not close to a Google. If you wanted to make a Google of Jay's meatballs, I mean, we could probably eat all those. It would take some time.
I would love to live long enough to eat all those.
But you would need 10 billion observable universes, fill them up with Jay's meatballs, and you would have a Google meatballs. So a big number.
You just made me think of something cool.
Yeah, go ahead.
A meatball planet.
Yeah.
Like Pluto, but it's a meatball.
Would it be one meatball?
Yes.
Or would it be many meatballs?
No. I want one. It would be one big meatball.
Just one giant meatball.
There'd be craters.
What would a meatball atmosphere look like?
Oh, that
sauce,
would be
sauce. Just like
the sauce. Marinara sauce.
So, yeah. You just walk with your mouth open, Kara, and you can eat. That's my goal in life.
So, in conclusion, though, Google's a fun number. Everyone kind of has heard of it. Mostly, but it's actually very small. In terms of the family of truly gargantuan numbers, Google is insignificant. If you look at numbers like Graham's number, or one of my new favorite numbers that I discovered today, this number is called, ready, Jay?
Yes.
Fish number 7. That's the number. Fish number 7. Those numbers are so truly gargantuan that I can't even really describe them in the time that I have today. But
a number now?
Fish number 7 and Graham's number pat Google on the head, and they kind of giggle at him because he's kind of lame
but
from their point of view.
Legit though, like, so some mathematician for some reason chose a specific number and then just said, "I'm going to call it fish number 7."
Yeah, these numbers are so truly big that no one's using these in a mathematical proof. Actually, fish number 7 was created by somebody that is part of like this Google group. He's actually a Googletician, something, some weird thing that he's in. And he said, I'm going to come up with this number and come up with a name for it. But it's really mathematical. I mean, you have
it's
to
significant.
Like, I read web pages about it and I still am not quite sure what it is, but that's how big it is. You can't, if you wrote it down on pieces of paper, the paper would fill the known universe and you still would barely scratch the surface of what that number truly is.
So we better get started.
All right. So that's it. We're done here with Google. This was, Bob, your number's up. Think of me fondly when your number's up.
All right, Bob. I'm a little surprised that the
Googleplex.
Googleplex.
Yeah. I meant to say it. I forgot. Whatever. It's Googleplex is 10 to the Google. So that's even a bigger number. But whatever. This is
no.
About
but
Google.
So it's a Google with a.
It's 10 to the Google, which is 10 to a 1 with 100 zeros. That's truly immense.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just another
huge
number.
Is there a number that's 10 to the Googleplex?
Sure. I don't know if it has a name, but the number certainly exists. I don't know if
of
it has a name.
Of course it exists. Because you can just keep doing that.
Yeah, of course. But even that number, Steve.
Literally ad infinitum.
But even that number is nothing compared to the truly big boys on the
I call
the
that number fish 9.
Yeah. Maybe they'll get there.
At what point, though, is it just indistinguishable from infinity? You know what I mean?
None of them even come close. Right.
Just getting started.
No, but to the human mind, that none of us can perceive it. There isn't a mathematician out there that truly can visualize this stuff. It leaps into fantasy. You might as well watch Star Wars for crying out loud when you talk about stuff like that.
So this is a cute little item. You guys see this yellow frog?
Is that a peep, like a marshmallow? You eat it?
No, it's an adorable, completely bright yellow
frog. That frog is so poisonous.
Oh, my God. The brighter the color, the more poisonous.
It would kill
you. That is an extremely toxic frog. The name of the species is Phyllobates terribilis.
Sounds
terrible. It's a terrible frog.
That's not fair.
And this frog is extremely poisonous. It creates a poison in its skin glands that is a sodium channel toxin. It binds to voltage-gated sodium channels. Now, that's important.
Your brain wouldn't like that.
Because your nerve cells, your brain and your nerves and your muscles use voltage-gated sodium channels to function. So, not functioning isn't a good thing. You'd be paralyzed. You wouldn't be able to move or do important things
like breathe.
No.
All right.
And, your heart also would be in trouble. And the name of that toxin is batrachotoxin.
Mm-hmm. Now, Steve, what would that frog do if you licked it and you just fell over paralyzed in front of it? What's he going to do to you?
Run away. This is a defense.
Oh, it's a defense. It's not him collecting food.
He's not going to open up his jaws like Jabba the Hutt and eat you or anything.
Good.
Yeah, it's just the predators, contact it, then it gives them the chance to get away. All right, so here's the question. Why doesn't the frog die from his own poison? That's the question.
It's because of the lifetime building up an immunity.
So
because he uses
you can't build up an immunity to it. You're either immune or you're not. So it would have had to have been something that they evolved as they were evolving the poison. You know, they're adapting to their own poison in some way. So one hypothesis is that they have evolved different voltage-gated sodium channels that don't bind to the toxin, right? So they're basically immune to their own toxin because they evolved different receptors that won't bind to it.
Well, Steve, but did I miss it? Where is that poison?
In their skin glands. It's a contact. So like if you touch it or lick it for some reason.
Well, couldn't the poison have been completely separated from like below the skin? It just could just isolated such that it can't get anywhere dangerous?
No, because so, he blinks his eyes. Yeah.
Get in his mouth.
It's a contact poison, so it's like meant to be absorbed through skin. So, but that's a fine hypothesis though, Bob. So we could say, okay, maybe his skin is impermeable to the poison, so it never gets into his system. That's not a viable hypothesis, but that's fine to think about that.
Thank you.
The first one was maybe he's immune to the poison.
Yeah.
So there's an easy way to test that. You inject the frog with his own poison and see what happens.
So what happened to him?
They get paralyzed. So they are not immune to their own poison.
What?
You can look at their sodium channels and also just, you know, examine them and say, yep, they bind to the toxin. They respond the way other animals respond to the toxin. So they're not immune to their own
poison. So my hypothesis is looking pretty good right now.
So do their orifices have some sort of neutralizing agent?
No. The toxin is not neutralized.
Do they have one of the infinity gems?
They have the yellow infinity gem.
There you go.
No. The other hypothesis, and so Bob, you're actually not too far off. It's not that it's impenetrable.
No, I thought he was talking about the infinity gem.
Not the infinity stone. The other hypothesis, because there are other animals where this is known to happen, is that they make proteins which act like sponges to the toxin, and it absorbs them and keeps them from getting to their nervous tissue. And so that right now is currently the leading hypothesis for why these frogs don't die from
the sponge never
toxin.
Fills up over the life of the frog.
They must excrete it at some point.
Yeah. Well, also, nothing survives forever, right? So the toxins will eventually break down, and then they just get metabolized and excreted. So you know how deadly this toxin is?
No.
How deadly is it?
So the skin of one frog, mm-hmm. This is the golden poison frog, is the common name, is estimated to carry 1 milligram of batrachotoxin. That's enough to kill between 10 and 20 adult humans.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
They're going to weaponize this frog.
That's a lot one frog can kill 20
I mean,
people.
You see that frog, you run screaming and grab 9 people.
Where is this frog?
Colombia.
So be careful in Colombia.
Yeah, yeah. The South America is where a lot of these poisonous, like dart frogs are.
Yeah, calm down.
There's also a bird.
PJ.
Yeah.
Pitohui birds also excrete the same exact toxin.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
Jay, what's the difference between poison and venom? Question for Jay.
I know the difference. I got it. No, isn't venom like when you bite, when something bites you?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Yeah. Venom is when something bites you. Poison is when you bite something.
Yeah, it's when you ingest it. Yeah. So if you bit that frog, it would still be it doesn't matter. If you bit him, you're dead anyway.
No, that frog's poison is not venomous. Its toxin is a poison, not a venom.
It is okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So they haven't proven yet that this frog has a protein that does this, but there are proteins that will soak up their toxin. Mm-hmm. And so that can exist. That exists in other animals. So they just need that final little piece. They have circumstantial evidence, basically. They're not immune. They are affected by their own toxin. Their toxin can be soaked up by protein, but now they just need to prove that this frog actually makes that protein.
I feel sorry for that little guy. He's just looking for love like everybody else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
How many animals had similar defense mechanisms but never survived, never could survive or get out of their own way and went extinct as a result?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, obviously this would be sort of co-evolve, right? Like as you're, like the more resistance or sequestration or whatever you can evolve, then the more toxic you can become.
I see.
Right? You can look
so
at
if you
it
make
that
it
way.
To that level, you've already passed the threshold. Of
yeah. So maybe they had just a little bit of toxin initially that their skin was able to protect them from, and then they evolved some mechanism to allow to be able to survive with greater and greater toxicity now 1 milligram will kill 20 people. Yeah.
They should have called that frog Rogue.
You think
kind
so?
Kind of like Rogue. X-Men. The X-Men, can't, yeah. Can't touch anybody.
Mm-hmm. You're right. They should have. Okay. Kara, this is an interesting topic I've encountered in different contexts. So this is about, you know, whether or not we should let children basically just roam the streets on their own, or how close we should keep them to home.
Right. And really, it's about some of the positive benefits of doing so. So there are some mild, slight generational differences between us. And I'm wondering, you know, when I was a kid, the rule was be home when the streetlights come on. What was the rule for you guys?
There were no rules when we were kids.
We didn't need it because when a dinner was about to happen, we all absolutely went inside.
If I could hear my parents' voices yelling for me, that's when I knew it was time to go home.
Be home for dinner.
So, yeah, I grew up in a really kind of sweet bedroom community. We would play down by the creek. We would go play on the playground that was near the school. Like, we were blocks and blocks away from home. Nobody had a cell phone. Nobody knew where we were. It's just the streetlights are on. Okay, my parents, I need to go home or I'm going to get in trouble. And I think that we're seeing, or we have seen, a massive shift, that a lot of younger children aren't free to roam, especially in urban areas. Mm-hmm. You do see it a little bit more in rural areas, but of course, there's been a massive generational shift. And a lot of scholars, they relate this, or they think the cause of this is simply like safety concerns from modern parents. But what we may be missing out on is something that's really important. So you guys have heard the term before, wayfaring.
No.
Not the glasses.
Or the online
store. What do you mean?
Am I using the right word, wayfaring?
I haven't heard that term.
Yeah, wayfinding. Apologies.
Wayfinding. Okay.
Wayfinding. So this is simply, you know, navigation in space, right?
Yeah.
One's ability to find their way to a new place. Maybe if there is some sort of thing in the road, they can go around it. They can take a new route. They can figure out how to get where they're going, figure out how to get back home. Most of us are very bad at this because of GPS. Right. But when we were kids, we would wayfind all the time. And there seem to be two different strategies for wayfinding. Most people use a combination of the two. One of them is looking at things like landmarks. And the other is thinking about things like cardinal directions. So, you know, we've all seen comedies where somebody's asking for directions in like a rural area and they're like, go past the third bale of hay, turn left at the giant rooster, you know, and they're like, what is even happening? As opposed to, in three blocks, you're going to look at the north side of the street and you're, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there has been a lot of evidence to show that there are gender differences in navigation ability.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been a lot of evidence to show that when those navigation skills, or even basic kind of like on neurological tests, neuropsychological tests, even basic processing, you know, like spatial processing testing, when trained, those gender differences tend to disappear. So even though people for decades, maybe even centuries, have been arguing that men are innately better at navigation than women, it doesn't seem to hold water, because the minute that women are trained the way that trained to do it, the gender differences go away. So the question is, why? Why are guys seemingly better? And how did they learn this skill? And new research may be pointing to the answer.
Isn't there also an urban-rural difference in which strategy you use? Like, the bale of hay versus the third left?
Absolutely. But there do seem to be heavy gender difference, even within that urban-rural difference.
It seems
to be gendered. Yeah, it seems to be that women tend to use the bale of hay and men tend to use the cardinal directions a little bit more often. And so, and we know that the cardinal direction strategy is more solid, right? Because if somebody removes the bale of hay, all of a sudden you're not turning left at the third bale of hay. And so we know that that one tends to be more valid. And unfortunately, women tend to use landmarks more often. So the question is, like, how do these gender differences occur? Why do they seem to be so persistent? And it looks to be the case that when children are young, between the ages, this study looked at self-report data, so it's kind of an entree, an opening into this question. I think they were looking at between the ages of 6 and 15, they found that there were significant differences in gender in who was traveling away from home, who was navigating the world on their own. And here's an interesting thing. It wasn't about how often they were able to do it. It wasn't about necessarily what they did when they traveled away from home. The highest predictor for ability to have high-level navigation skills in adulthood was how far from home they were able to travel.
Hmm.
So boys in youth socially, they are socialized that they're able to leave home and travel farther without adult supervision.
Okay.
For whatever reason, parents feel safer letting their boys navigate the world at a young age and not letting their girls. And that seems to have a correlation with how well we have spatial navigation in adulthood. And it's a really interesting kind of piece of that puzzle as to why study after study show gender differences, but they also show that those gender differences can be corrected through training. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be an innate difference. It seems to be a learned difference. Yeah. But why did we learn it and when? It could be as early as the age of 6. If we're able to navigate on our own, to learn new paths, to roam, we might be developing those skills. And when girls are kept home or told they're not allowed to at the level that boys are, we're already starting to affect these gender differences.
So is it safe to assume that we're just more protective of girls than we are of boys?
You know, the study actually didn't ask that question. It wasn't interested in, or, you know, it couldn't ask all of these questions. And so I'd say everything's safe to assume and nothing is safe to assume. That's probably something that, you know, needs further research. But as a parent, obviously there's face validity to that answer, is there not? Like, is that how you feel when you think about your boy? You have a boy and a girl.
I do.
So how do you feel about that?
Well, my daughter is, you know, 2.5 years younger than my son. So he's 8 and she's, you know, almost 6. And yeah, I mean, I'm way more protective of her just out of the box. I don't know why. You know, there might be a little daddy's little girl thing going on. I just think that my son can, I'm not as worried at him being outside getting hurt or being able to communicate that he needs help as much as she is, but that could be the age difference. So it's hard to say.
Could be an age difference, but it's interesting you say that because there's a lot of good evidence to show that your son is much more likely to get hurt playing outside than your daughter. And so it is funny that we are socialized to think that girls are less capable, right, when they're alone navigating the world to avoid harm, less capable of being independent in that way. Even though we know that boys tend to be rowdier and they tend to be riskier in their play.
Yeah,
and they're
right.
Actually more likely to get hurt when they're unsupervised. So it's a very interesting social component. And it would be cool to see if there are gender differences in cultures, you know, navigational differences in gender in cultures where girls are treated differently. Maybe some indigenous cultures, for example, where navigation is very important. It's just a really interesting study. Of course, it has a lot of limitations. This was, let's ask a bunch of college undergrads about their experience and, you know, like, let's rely on self-report of memory and things like that. But it, I think it opens up an area of inquiry that could be really interesting.
And yeah, the other question that I would think would be interesting to explore is there a generational difference? You know, we talk a lot about like helicopter parenting, and a lot of psychologists have raised concerns about the fact, you know, the helicopter parents coming from the notion that like, parents are hovering over their children, protecting them from every adversity that might come their way. And are we raising a generation of children that are just not prepared for the rough and tumble world out there?
Absolutely.
It has immediate face validity, but I'm always interested in hard data on that.
Absolutely. And you add to that face validity and this idea that there's just a generational change in terms of how much we trust our kids being out in the world, how much we trust the world as a source of harm versus a source of enrichment. But there's also, you know, there are changes in not legislation, but in like, what's the word I'm looking for? There have been kind of enmeshed cultural changes in terms of capabilities. Like when I was growing up, when I was very young, 6, 7 years old, I walked to school. Mm-hmm. It was only a few blocks from my house. I walked to school every morning. Now, at least in Los Angeles, parents, like kids aren't allowed to leave. They're not allowed to just walk out of school at the end of the day. They have to wait for a parent to pick them up. This is a massive change with how I was raised, for example. And so I think that you add the way that people parent, the way that, you know, schools enforce these safety protocols.
There's liability
you add to it
issues.
Things like which didn't exist in the past. You know, I don't think I'm probably nearly as capable of navigation. I'm so reliant on my GPS. And it might be hard to tease all those things out, but I bet you we could develop some really interesting studies for sure.
Well, my anecdotal experience with my kids is the second, you know, if I'm not working, of course, if I'm at work, I have to focus on work and I'm not watching the kids. But if I'm watching the kids, you know, if I'm you know, let's say it's after work. If they go outside, I have a clock in my head that starts ticking. And I need to lay eyes on them every 10 minutes. I can't just be like, yeah, go have fun for a couple hours. Like when we were kids.
My God.
We would be in the backyard. I'd be riding my bike to 7-Eleven. Like my mom didn't see me for half a day.
Wait, you went to 7-Eleven?
Yeah.
Why don't you bring me?
Because you
would have gone with you.
Because you didn't have a bike when I did. No, but you're kind of blowing my mind, Kara, because I'm realizing now, I'm keeping tabs on my kids in a way that my parents didn't do that to me.
Yeah, they just trusted. And I guess the question is the world more dangerous than it was back then? Or do we just have more information? We're watching the news more. We're on social media. And so we are more paranoid as parents. I'm not a parent, but, you know, our generation is more paranoid about children's safety, even though all things are relatively equal.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Is it actually more risky for the kids to be out?
We also have gone from this rural to urban lifestyle. Whereas, you know, kids who grew up on the farm way back when, you know, if that was the majority of families, it was just a totally different experience for them. Of course they were out and about doing all sorts of dangerous things on the farm, dealing with animals in the next field over, and just being out and about just seemed to be more of a natural way of life back then. Whereas now, or in more modern times, there's less of that influence on the day-to-day life of those people.
Yeah.
But don't forget that there have always been kids living in places like New York City. And these kids are very street savvy. I know a lot of young kids who ride the subway to school on their own, who can get on multiple buses to get to school and to get home. So even though there are some urban-rural differences, I think when we look at the extremes, they color the normal curve a little bit. Because in very, very intense urban centers, many kids are quite navigable. And they're capable of doing it. I think where we're seeing a lot of the difference is actually in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Sandy Hook shooting, that was like the parental equivalent of watching Jaws as a kid. Like from that moment forward, my paranoia was like, and has been really bad. Like my kids are at school and I'm worrying about them. You know, I don't know how good is the security, you know, and I'm always, whenever I drop them off or pick them up at school, especially during COVID, we were dropping them off and picking them up every day for quite a while. And I'm really looking at, like, you know, is there a police officer around? You know, are they letting the kids just walk out and let anybody pick them up? You know, how secure is the whole process? So that changed. I think, you know, those incidents are happening around the country. You know, there's lots of school shootings.
There weren't school shootings like that when we were children.
Yeah.
And that is a big difference. It's an extreme example, but it is a big difference. But in terms of the safety of walking from home to school, are the number of kidnappings higher? Probably not. I mean, it would be interesting to really look at the data, but I think a big difference is just the amount of every parent is on Nextdoor obsessing over every, you know, every incident of crime in their neighborhood, or they know exactly where all of the sex predators are living when we didn't have those kinds of databases in the past. I think a lot of it has to do with information overload as well, which primes us to being more fearful.
I agree. We have a neighborhood thing where, like, you know, if somebody that lives near us spots a bear, you know, my wife and I can see it. And we, you know, we're like, oh yeah, last night they had a black bear. Like then the next day, I'm like, I'm not letting the kids out today. You know, like I agree with you.
I think it's also been a bigger cultural shift. Like even within the education culture, there's been a shift towards, more nurturing, less adversity. And I think a lot of it's probably perfectly legitimate. But you know, like, if you look at the evidence, students are happier and do better and respond better when they have only positive reinforcement. But, you know, and this gets made fun of a lot. Like if you watch The Simpsons, like, oh, everybody wins. You know, it's like that kind of thing. Nobody ever has to go through the pain of losing or the pain of not even being as praised as much as the next kid. I mean, it really gets to extreme degrees. But this is like, well, this is evidence-based. This is the way we do things now. The outcomes are better. But I wonder if they're focusing too much on short-term outcomes. It's like, sure, they may respond better and be happier now, but then, you know, when they get older, are they going to collapse the first time somebody gives them real criticism?
Yeah.
Because they've never had to face that at any point. And I think that's a legitimate concern.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm always interested when there's, you know, the more objective evidence I can find about that. Because I don't want to just fall for my bias, you know.
Yep.
You know,
right.
You
because know, I can say, anecdotally, at least in the, actually not even beyond anecdotally in the psychology literature, you do see that children who are incredibly high achieving tend to have some adverse psychological outcomes when they first enter into a college environment where they're surrounded by other people that are high achieving. Yeah. So kids who are like the valedictorian, the salutatorian at their high school, always did the best, never really kind of ran into a lot of difficulty or competition. Now all of a sudden they're at like Harvard, Yale, Stanford. They're surrounded by other people that are at their level and they're not perfect and they're struggling and they're having to work much harder to make the A. Yeah. And you do see a lot of negative psychological consequences from that adversity because they didn't develop the resiliency that life throws at you. So yeah, it's a resilience question.
It's a resilience
People
question.
Develop resiliency because of difficulty.
Sure.
And so the question is, how do we find that sweet spot where they're not having adverse child experiences, right? Abuse, neglect, things of that nature.
Yeah.
We don't want to have to induce that kind of resiliency, but healthy, normative struggles that then lead to more resilient outcomes.
I would say just off the top of my head, like sports, I think would probably be, very mentally healthy for kids, not just physically healthy, but mentally healthy because, if you're on a sports team, you're going to lose from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be something.
Yeah, but that can also kind of be taken too far as well. Mm-hmm. I think, it's about that balance. And we've seen that at the Olympics this year with people like Simone Biles saying like, enough is enough. At a certain point, I have to protect myself. I'm a person doing this. I'm not a pawn for everybody's entertainment. And I love my favorite. This is my favorite, you guys. What's the tennis player's name?
Which one?
Bjorn Borg.
Djokovic.
He's 30 years behind that.
No.
Djokovic. So you guys saw this amazing thing that he, when asked about Simone Biles not competing, he was like, at this level of competition, you've got to be able to handle the pressure and you've got to be tough and you've got to,
that guy's a jackass.
It's like it's part of the job. And then 2 days later, he had a meltdown on the court when he lost and like threw his racket into the stands and was beating it on the ground and displayed the worst sportsmanship you can imagine. Yeah.
And he's a pseudoscientist.
That makes it 10 times worse,
He's clueless.
And he's a poster boy for pseudoscience. Beware him.
Yeah. And again, there's always a sweet spot, as you say, in the middle where now, you don't want to break our children down because we're like, they have to be competing at the top 0.001% of the world. But just to give one more example before we move on, like even just in a medical education context, like I have been told you shouldn't tell students that they're wrong. It's like, yeah, but what if they are wrong?
What do you mean?
How do you learn if you're not told you're wrong?
It's not like that's a good thought, but let's go over here. It's like, how about, no, that's objectively wrong. Let me explain to you why that's objectively wrong.
So you that don't make this mistake in the future.
So you told them they were wrong about being wrong. But again, this is the evidence supports that position in terms of like, if you testing outcomes or whatever, but I still wonder if it's long-term, if that really is the best approach.
Yeah.
But, right. What is the evidence pointing to? What is the validity? Is it that 5 minutes later, they have a slightly better mood?
Yeah.
Or is it that in the future, they have better psychological outcomes and more earning potential or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, this is a bigger discussion that we're not going to resolve here, but it's interesting. Oh. This conflict that I think is underway. All right, Jay, how quickly are we going to be able to adopt electric vehicles?
Yeah. Well, first off, when you say we,
the world.
Yeah, I mean, I have some information about the United States, and then I have a little bit of global information as well. But the reason why we're talking about this is because recently the U.S. committed to getting to 50% electric or EV vehicles. I shouldn't say that because EV means electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. So EVs by 2030. Right. So we're 9 years.
Good numbers.
Right. 9 years away from hopefully getting to the point where half the cars that are sold or vehicles that are sold are electric. That is a really tall order. And immediately, is it possible? So there's a lot of details. Like we've got to dig into the details here because there's so much to consider. So first and foremost, of course, the car companies have to be on board because that's where we're going to get the cars. And the good news is, and I'll get into more details in a minute, but some of the largest U.S. car manufacturers are saying, yep, let's do it. We're already talking about it. We already got it heavily in the pipeline, which is great because they have their finger on the pulse. The car manufacturers are always looking to the latest innovation. As an example, like the backup camera on your car. that, you know, that used to be a thing that you pay extra for. Today, pretty much every car has it because it's just expected at this point.
Love it.
Yeah, and electric vehicles are going to be something that's just simply expected. Getting to 50% adoption in 10 years seems like a huge change in an incredibly short amount of time. But, you know, the one of the main factors that we have to consider here is our starting point. So, you know, 50%, where are we now? Well, in the U.S., we're at 4%. So the United States is selling about, you know, all vehicles that are sold, 4% are electric. And I got to be honest with you, that number is even higher than I thought it would be. Because, you know, my gut before I did my research on this, because I always like to check myself before I go in, because I'm usually surprised that, you know, after learning more about it, how wrong I am. I thought it was more like 1.5 to 2%. And the other thing that we have to consider here is it's not just the putting the vehicles on the road, but it's the grid. Where's our grid? Where is our grid right now, and where would it need to be in order to pull this off? So are consumers going to buy these next generation vehicles? What are your thoughts right now, very briefly, just on buying an electric car? Steve, you just bought one. Kara, don't you own one?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, no. I lease. Sorry, but I'm on my third EV, so I've been driving electric for 10 years.
Right. So you're an early adopter. You're totally into it. Steve, you've been talking about it for a while.
Yeah. And so yeah, it was just a matter of crossing that threshold, and we haven't bought a new car in 6 years or whatever. So this is just the next one that we were getting, but at this point, I'm not going to buy any cars that are not, you know, full electric.
Wow, you're fully committed now. Yeah. Okay, how about you, Evan and Bob? Where are you guys at?
I'm still using the old-fashioned internal combustion engine.
Yep.
At the moment.
Bob, you got any plans or anything to buy an electric car?
I'm going to buy a steam engine car.
Yeah,
I'm so close. I'm in the market for a car, and I'm so close to going electric. One of the big deal breakers right now is I need a big storage in the back, and I'm not seeing any that have a lot of really good storage. That's kind of very important for me. But
Bob wants more junk in the trunk.
To go in electric.
Oh, well, Bob, keep in mind that many electric cars have their batteries underneath, so they may have a frunk and a trunk.
Yeah, but if I'm going to put a corpse in the back of my car, it's got to be, I need some room.
You got to have 6 feet.
Also,
horizontal.
I would recommend looking at, you know, like I drive a Chevy Bolt. They're about to do, or they just did the EUV, which is what they're calling like their SUV version of the Bolt. But even as a hatchback car, the back seats fold completely flat. So you've got all this space that you can fill up the hatch. And this is my favorite feature. Well, one of my favorite features. My car also has a bird's eye view camera, which is like priceless. One of my favorite features is you can flip the rear view mirror, and it turns into a rear view camera. So even if your car is full of boxes, you can see behind.
Oh, that's really smart. Cool. That's really smart. All right, so getting back into it.
Yeah, there's a lot of tech, like good tech in EVs. Yeah.
So my wife and I are looking to get a new car as well. We were like, our cars are about to just turn to rust. You know, like we're like at the very end of the lifespan of both of these cars.
Total existence failure.
The first thing that I worry about is the infrastructure, meaning where are the charging stations? You know, can I charge? Because you have to either buy a way to charge it at home. You know, then you got to start leaning in a little bit to, should I get solar panels? Do I need a big battery at home? Or do I just rely on exterior charging resources and all that? And it's a legitimate concern because, as you know, you're not driving past hundreds of charging stations as you go from point A to point B around your house. So we're going to need a lot of charging stations everywhere. So that's going to be a big change. And those stations are going to need a robust grid. What I'm hearing is that the current grid can handle millions more cars. I tried to get an exact number, and I think we're somewhere below 5 million, which is not that many new cars. But beyond that, the grid is going to have to then start to get seriously upgraded. So I have a question for you guys now. So how many charging stations do you think exist in the United States right now?
I would say 5,000.
You said how many charging stations?
Yeah, just in the United States, because that's the only information I could find.
I mean, charging station locations.
25,000?
How many individual locations are there?
Locations.
You're not talking about people who have their own stations. You're talking about public charging stations?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. 20,000? No, is that high?
No, actually, there's 43,000 stations.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. It's a big number.
Mostly on the coast.
But it actually isn't a lot.
How many gas stations are there?
They're all in LA, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, 99%
right,
of them.
Yeah, concentrate.
So the U.S. is trying to finalize their funding right now. If you've been paying attention to the politics, like they're having they're still debating it. But if they get the money, we want to add 500,000 charging stations.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that number wasn't just plucked out of thin air. I guess that's like, that will have a good penetration that'll give people access to what they need in order to really ramp up the sales of EVs. So like I said, so experts are saying that, you know, we can only handle about, millions, below 5 million more cars on the current grid. And the interesting fact here is that they estimate that we would only have to increase our overall grid, the distribution of electricity by 25%. So if everybody had an electric car, the grid would only have to be able to pump out 25% more electricity.
That's
to
a
handle
lot,
it.
Though.
It yeah, is a lot. It is a lot. But I would think, for some reason, my gut was telling me that it would have been lot more than 25%.
That's huge, though. That's a huge increase in the amount of electricity. Yep.
But also, I think that it's leaving out the a third variable, a correlative variable, which is that people who are more likely to drive electric are also more likely to invest in solar. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that you're going to see that there's going to be, as people surge in electric consumption, they're also going to be surging in solar usage. And I feel like you can't decouple the two completely because it's a lifestyle choice and you see a lot of correlation baked in there.
Yeah, but
geography.
If we get to 50% new cars being electric, that correlation may not hold up as we get to,
maybe.
And also, there's a huge delays in the adoption of distributed solar like that because our energy grid would need to be massively upgraded in order to handle that much solar. So again, this is kind of the overall issue is that, sure, we could say we're going to sell all these electric vehicles. We're just going to demand that car companies sell 50% electric by 2030. But there are lots of logistical hurdles in the way, putting out more electricity, updating the grid, installing more charging stations. There's also issues, Jay, with raw materials. Mm-hmm. Where are we going to get all these batteries going to come from?
Yeah, I know that's a major concern right now. Like, as we're ramping up, people are worried right now, like, where are we going to get the materials to do all this? And the recycling technology is not there yet. So another issue that consumers are facing that's in the way right now is cost. So electric vehicles are more expensive, as most people know, than gasoline vehicles. Now, the prices vary wildly, of course. Like, if you go on Tesla's website, you could very easily spend $100,000 on an electric car if you want to. But, if you look at their most reasonably priced car and you compare it to something comparable, right, you want to find something, so you're kind of doing apples to apples, you're going to find that you're going to spend between $10,000 and $20,000 more for an electric vehicle. Versus a gasoline car. So the U.S. government is offering buyer incentives, meaning they'll give you money back if you buy an electric car. That's great. But those incentives don't last forever. And the reason why governments do that type of thing is to help kickstart an industry. You see it all the time. So it's not going to last forever. But now if you go out, you could get $5,000 back or, I've seen up to $7,000 coming back from the government if you buy a car.
Oh, $7,500. I think in California, it's like $7,500 federal plus like $2,000 or $3,000 state rebate. Plus, I've driven electric so much that I don't get rebates anymore. But this is my favorite perk, HOV stickers.
Ooh.
Yeah. I can drive in the HOV lane anytime I want.
That's actually pretty cool.
So, and it's so helpful in California traffic.
So why would a consumer right now buy an electric car? What are the reasons here? So I'm seeing a lot of different data. So some sources are saying that over the lifetime of owning the vehicle, you can save around $5,000. And that $5,000 would come from gasoline prices. And I think it would be more money. You'd save even more money on maintenance, but I haven't seen any reliable estimates on maintenance charges over the lifespan of the car. I've only seen predictions up to 3 years. So my overall impression of everything that I read, it's kind of a wash. You're really not going to save that much money.
I don't know that I would agree with that. I mean, I've read a lot about if you do the full life cycle assessment of an electric vehicle, there's definitely a money saving for the life of the car.
Yeah, but what would you say that is? Because what I was reading was when all things factored in,
even external costs.
Well, it depends on how long you drive the car. The longer you drive it, the more the advantage.
That's true.
Yeah.
What's the average life of a car on the road in the U.S. today? What do you think?
Didn't we talk about that?
The average age of a car.
Not how long could the car last, but how long do people drive?
Of all cars right now, what's the average age of the cars on the road?
75,000 miles.
No, how many years? Years. In years.
12, like 12
years.
Seven, yeah.
12 years.
12 years.
12 years.
Yeah.
12 years. Yeah. And it's going up. It was 11. Now it's 12.
And the electric pays off at 8 years, right? Is that where the...
I think it depends on the car and the price of gas and how much you're paying for electricity. So there are some variables in there, but it's, I've read like 5 years, 6 years, something in there. So most people are driving cars much longer than the payback period of the savings for the electric car. Yeah.
Okay. Jay, doesn't your calculation, it's kind of looking at it as if cost is the only option. And I get that cost is a massive motivator for people, but many people are willing to spend an extra few bucks for a reusable bottle as opposed to buying individual plastic bottles. And I'm not, obviously this is a function of privilege. Not everybody is in a position where they can buy or lease an electric car right now, but for many people, it's not about the cost. That's not why we do it. We do it because it's better for the planet.
You're straight up just not buying gasoline, and hopefully, you know, we're getting more and more of our electricity is coming from renewables as the years go by. So, you know, because there are people that have argued with me, oh, well, they're generating the gasoline, you know, to get the electricity by using fossil fuels. And, you know, that's not incorrect. So right now is an interesting statistic. The U.S., in the United States, gas vehicles create one quarter of the country's greenhouse gases. And that is the, by far the biggest single producer of pollution. And experts say that we can't mitigate global warming unless we straight up get rid of gas vehicles. Of course, it makes perfect sense. Let me get to the changes that are going on in the manufacturing industry. So big changes have already happened. Now, this was the eye opener for me. I didn't realize that things were rolling as hard as they are right now. So several of the major car manufacturers made announcements that they will be rolling out electric versions of existing models or new EV models. Experts in the field believe the goal that the U.S. has to reach 50% electric car sales is absolutely reachable. And here's just a few companies out of a lot that are doing it. But Jaguar has committed to sell electric vehicles only starting at 2025. Volvo and General Motors have committed to fully shift to EVs by 2030, so that's 9 more years. And Ford says that they're going to be moved to full EV in Europe by 2030. I guess the U.S. will come a little bit later. But if you look at their website, Ford has an amazing array of EV vehicles on there. They really have gone for it. They have pickup trucks and all different types of vehicles, you know, heavy-duty vehicles and an SUV that's a hybrid. They have a lot of great hybrid. They have a lot of great options on there. So, and there's a lot, many, many more car manufacturers that are already making EVs, and the trend indicates that we're going to see significant changes in the amount of EVs on the road very soon. According to
The amount of EVs being sold, not on the road.
Yeah,
because there's a delay. There's a significant delay.
Oh hell yeah! What was your delay on your Tesla, Steve?
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about even if let's say we meet Biden's goal of 50% cars sold in the United States are going to be EV, and by 2030, by 2050, most cars on the road are still going to be internal combustion. It's still going to be gasoline. So because people hold on to their cars for so long, you know, we really need to get to like 100% by 2030 if we want to meet our 2050 goal of like no carbon by 2050 or carbon neutral. We're not going to make it.
Physically cannot happen.
So the interesting thing and the thing that I really loved about researching this was finding out just how good the technology is right now. So electric motors have made huge technical leaps in the last 10 years, along with the hardware and software that control them. That was very important because, you know, these electric motors have to be efficient. And there was a lot of things that had to evolve, and the technology had to get to a certain point. Charging stations have also made technological improvements. But the shining star of all of this is what? Is battery technology. Yeah, battery technology. The costs have come down by an order of magnitude. We finally now see battery technology where it needs to be to start mass production of electric cars. It's here right now. The batteries are good enough. Now, the batteries are lasting longer, and they're steadily becoming more energy dense. Now, we've said on the show a million times, talk about batteries for the last 16 years. We're constantly talking about battery technologies. There hasn't been a major breakthrough since we've been doing this podcast. There hasn't been this one singular event where we're like, oh my God, now our phones are going to last three times as long. That's not happening. But what has happened is exactly what Steve, I remember you saying this a long time ago, slow incremental progress has been happening. And what happened recently is we did get over a line. There is a line that exists now where the batteries are good enough where they're going to last long enough for the average consumer to be in an EV and not even feel the distance limit, which is great. That means it's here. We're happening right now. And again, you know, I wanted to remind everyone that what Steve brought up before about the, there is concerns about battery shortage and the raw materials and everything. Our recycling technology, we know how to recycle the batteries. We know how to reclaim them. And what's funny is the recycling facilities are saying there isn't enough batteries to recycle yet because we don't have enough.
So they're storing them?
No, there just isn't enough people using these big car batteries to make a big difference yet. Like,
yeah, we have 3% of the cars are EV, and we want to go to 60, 70, 100%. Obviously, we need to increase the number of batteries out there. We can't just recycle the existing ones.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, KiwiCo.
Hey, guys. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects designed to expose kids of all ages to concepts, math, engineering, art, science, and technology. KiwiCo's mission is to help kids build confidence, creativity, critical thinking skills, and have a blast while doing it. Each crate is designed by experts and tested by kids and teaches a new science, technology, engineering, art, and math concept. Each box is delivered monthly and comes with all the supplies needed for that month's project, plus detailed kid-friendly instructions and an enriching magazine filled with content to learn more about the crate's theme.
So KiwiCo has something called a doodle crate. This is for ages 9 to 16 and older. This is really cool. So what it does is it actually teaches your children how to make different things. And the one that I'd like to talk about right now is the handmade soap. You could teach your child how to make homemade handmade soap. You can color it. They have different shapes and different things that you could do. And it teaches them how to do it. And it could, you never know, it could spark their curiosity to make other things.
KiwiCo is redefining learning with hands-on projects that build confidence, creativity, and critical thinking skills. There's something for every kid or kid at heart at KiwiCo. Get 50% off your first month plus free shipping on any crate line with code SKEPTICS. That's 50% off your first month at KiwiCo.com. Promo code SKEPTICS.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
This is an interesting little design. This is a proof of concept kind of thing. So we talk a lot about artificial intelligence, and there's a lot of technological hurdles that we need to get through in order to get to the point where we have, say, an artificial general intelligence at a human level. One of the factors that we don't talk about a lot is that the existing computer technology that we have uses up a lot more energy than biological neurons. Give me an order of magnitude estimate. How much more energy does silicon technology use versus brain in terms of how much it costs per the same amount of information?
Oh my God, I'd say millions. I know that one of the big stumbling blocks for the next biggest petaflop, exaflop supercomputer is that it would take the power of a small city to actually run the thing. So it's orders of magnitude.
Yeah. So it's, you're actually overstated it by a little bit. It's tens of thousands of times.
Okay.
Right. So yeah. So if we had a computer that was as powerful as a human brain, it would use tens of thousands of times the energy that our brain does.
It would just melt into a mess.
And of course, all the heat generation is a lot. So
biology beats.
Totally. Yeah, biology is way more efficient than our current technology.
The human brain is like a 100 watt bulb or 60 watt bulb.
The figure I like is that, your brain, you can keep your brain functioning for a day on the energy contained in three bananas.
Yeah.
So the banana scale, which I think is very, very useful. But yeah, but that, again, that would take tens of thousands of times the energy. So one of the reasons that is the case is because computers transfer information with electrons and our brains transfer information with
M&Ms.
Ions. They could be fueled by M&Ms. But they're not electrons, they're ions. We talked about the poisonous frog and the sodium channel, blocker.
Yeah.
So they have like potassium chloride and sodium channels. These are ions, right? So a charged, atom, not electrons themselves. And that is much more energy efficient than using electrons. Yeah. So the idea is, how can we design an artificial neuron that functions with ions rather than electrons?
Oh my God, Steve, we're going to basically be building synthetic brains.
Well, that's the goal.
And the robots are going to take us over.
Yeah. We'll become the robots. This is just a proof of concept. These researchers we're looking at using Bob nanofluidics, another cool nano word to add to your repertoire. Nanofluidics.
Like nanofluidics.
So technically, nanofluidics deal with fluids, how they behave, going through channels less than 100 nanometers wide. And they made these channels, these nanometer, you know, small channels with
3D printing?
Graphene. With graphene.
Of course,
graphene.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And then what they were able to show, so then they had, again, ions, not electrons, ions would cluster as they were transported through these tiny graphene channels.
Mm-hmm. And cluster?
And in so doing, they were able to store information in them and made them function as if they were a memristor.
Oh my God.
Right? So a memristor is a computer component that is both a transistor and can store memory. And so it functions more like a neuron, you know, than say a typical, you know, computer transistor.
So why were they cluster? Is that something that was unexpected?
That's what they were looking for. Like what happens when we pass ions through these tiny graphene channels?
It's kind of like Cooper pairs in superconductivity.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon that can be exploited to create, to store information. They were able to actually store information, memristor style, in this system. So this is the very beginning, and this is a proof of concept. Again, using nanofluidics and ions, they were able to create this sort of primitive memristor. And now the next step is to string a bunch of these together and see if they could train them like you would like a neural network, for example. See if you could, you know, train it with an algorithm to essentially start to build it into like a narrow, you know, AI. And then, you know, hopefully eventually when we perfect the technology, we could build computer brains out of it. This is so early though in this technology. Again, I do think this is the kind of thing that if we are using some version of this, it would be 20, 30 years from now, you know, but it's a great proof of concept. But I was just like to get that idea out there that this is one of those big stumbling blocks with existing AI technology is the massive amount of energy that they need to use to get to the level of computing power that our brains have, and also just how amazingly evolved vertebrate brains are. They are an incredibly efficient information processing machines.
Yeah, millions of years of R&D.
All right, Evan.
Oh, gosh.
So this is very interesting. You know, we were pre-gaming this one a lot because Bob, Evan, and I wanted to make sure we wrapped our heads around what the key bit is here. This is a 5 to 10 year follow-up, but there's an interesting bit of science at the core of this that I want to get to, but go ahead.
Okay, so 5 to 10 years, which is something, we like to explore. We go back, we take a look at a news item that we reported on somewhere from 5 to 10 years ago and kind of give you an update on where things are with that particular news item. So in January 2013, Bob, you presented a news item explaining that an international team of astronomers claimed to have discovered the largest known structure in the universe.
Yes.
Right? A cluster of 73 quasars spanning how big? 4 billion light years.
Yes.
4 billion light years. And Bob, you said you had converted that to millimeters, 38 octillion millimeters.
It's a lot of millimeters, man.
It is.
I remember.
And I went ahead and converted that into a Planck length.
No way.
Yeah,
That's awesome, dude.
2.3 novemdecillion Planck length.
Nice.
2.3 plus 59 zeros on the end.
Yes.
Not quite as big as the other numbers we're talking
Not
about.
Not a Google, but impressive
but
nonetheless.
It is still impressive. So it's called the huge LQG, Large Quasar Gathering.
The fragged huge.
It is huge. I mean, 4 billion.
That's impossible.
It practically is impossible. It's enormous. You know, these things are just so luminous, so energetic. Bob, this is all stuff you were explaining in that episode. You can go back to episode 392 if you care to listen to Bob's original report on this. Huge gravitational gradient, lots of friction, super hot, radiation spilling out all over the place. That's why we can observe them from billions of light years away and how long ago in time that these things actually formed. They shine about 1,000 times brighter than our own Milky Way galaxy, but they are so far away. Mm. Now, when first observed, these redshifts were actually off the charts. They basically, it put the galaxy clusters to shame as far as the redshift goes. So it went far, far beyond that. So big, so it made scientists reconsider the basic, one of the basic principles about space, the cosmological principle, which is what we were talking about, which means, basically, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, if you observe a relatively small sample of the universe, it's implied that what you're seeing there is consistent throughout anywhere you look in the universe.
Yeah. Well, okay, just to clarify, though, that a little bit. If you observe actually a large enough amount of the universe, it will display homogeneity.
Right.
Right. And so there's two principles that make up the cosmological principle. One is isotropy, and the other one is homogeneity. Isotropy is no matter what direction you look at, the universe will have the same information, the same sort of structure.
Right. That's you, one person looking in different directions.
And homogeneity that it follows is, the same rules. Is that what you're talking
that
about?
That and it's, basically it's the same.
Same laws of physics is part of that definition.
Right. But also like in the amount of matter that you'll be looking at and things like that. But in homogeneity is no matter where you are in the universe, it'll be the same.
Right, so there's no special area of the universe.
There's no center
at the
universe.
Edge of the universe. So we're seeing different stuff than you're seeing way over there. No, not
How
happening.
Can you not be? But
what?
Right.
Forget it.
No, but the thing is, so of course, like, so you might be thinking, Jay's like, well, if I'm looking up at the night sky and I look at one direction, it doesn't look the same as if I look in the other direction. It's like that there, you might be seeing the Milky Way in one direction.
Yeah.
But that's why it's only when you have a big enough scale.
Right.
When the scale is big enough, then you have homogeneity. And isotropy.
Right.
And
you're looking at small scales. If you're looking up at your galaxy, you're looking at very small scales.
Yeah.
So you're going to see breaks in homogeneity.
Right. And then technically, you get to homogeneity when the difference is less than 1%. Right.
Okay.
That's when they consider, okay, now we're at the scale of homogeneity. The problem here is that these alleged structures were bigger than is allowed for with homogeneity. They should not have existed at that size. Is because there also hasn't been enough time in the universe.
Not enough time in the universe.
Gravity,
big bang, right.
Should not have been able to act over that distance. So that's why it implies
alien technology
that homogeneity is wrong.
Oh. Correct. That's right.
Because you can't. Because right, our galaxy breaks homogeneity at a small scale because of gravity. Because all the stars are bound together.
And there was enough time for that.
And there's enough time for that to happen.
Enough time for it.
But there wasn't enough time for this to form. So is the cosmological principle wrong?
That was the question at the time, and this is why it kind of threw everything into flux. I'm like, oh gosh. So I decided to take a look and say, okay, well, that was 8.5 years ago. So let's take a look and see where we are now with this. So this is again 8.5 years after this announcement, and here's the most recent development. I found an article on this May of this year, or at least an attempt to explain how something as large as 4 billion light years, the structure fits into basically something that's only supposed to contain 1.2 billion light years, which is supposed to be the maximum. You're stuffing 4.4 billion stuff into a 1.2 billion pound bag, or light year bag. How does that work? Well, the explanation is this. These large groups may not exist at all.
A
total artifact. Yeah, basically what they're reading and interpreting is not really there. Yeah. So, I mean, that's incredible to think. You know, that as we're learning more and more about it, they may have to actually, they suddenly slam on the brakes and say, no, your observations were wrong. Your algorithms basically were wrong in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, this article is by Ethan Siegel. He's a science writer and astrophysicist. He wrote a piece for Forbes, and here's the headline: the largest structures in the universe may not actually exist. And he starts by talking about homogeneity. Which Steve went into. The Big Bang simultaneously occurred everywhere. All locations had equivalent temperatures. But there are little imperfections as you go out through time. Very, very small ones that take a real long time to accumulate. Well, eventually they do build up and you come up with things like the galaxies that we have now. But I mean, you have to allow so much time to go, to have passed. This is where we get these galactic superclusters, which Steve at the time in 2013, you had mentioned to Bob in the, when we were talking about the article, it's like, isn't that the largest structure? We thought that it was because that is consistent with
the cosmological principle.
Yes, exactly.
Clarify something for me.
Yeah.
Cause what I'm confused about is, so we're using instruments to look at this stuff. Reading the electromagnetics.
Mainly the Hubble.
The Hubble observation.
And, you know, because for people who are listening to the podcast version of this in the future, they're not going to be able to see the picture that we're looking at. We're looking at some artist rendition.
Yeah, this is not irrelevant to the news item.
No.
But so when you say a structure, you're talking about a collection of matter.
So
that is gravitationally bound together.
So specifically, this is a bunch of quasars.
Yeah.
Now the quasars are real. Those quasars are out there.
That's right.
The question was using Hubble data, this deep view, like looking really, really deep, far into the past.
Are they bound?
Are they bound to each other gravitationally? And that's like a statistical kind of assessment. And what the new thing is saying is that the algorithm they used to examine all of these quasars, suggesting that they're gravitationally bound, was wrong.
Okay, that,
and they're not gravitationally bound to each other. They're out there. Those quasars exist. They're just not bound to each other. So that isn't a structure.
Right. Got it.
It's
got
just, and so homogeneity is not violated, right, and the cosmological principle is safe.
So everything goes back to normal.
Yes.
Now we can relax.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. However, we don't yet still have that proof. We need a better instrument than Hubble.
Yeah.
And that instrument is coming. It is the Nancy Grace Roman telescope. There's a superhero science for you, Bob.
Yes.
Nancy Grace Roman, considered the mother of Hubble. Because she, put in a lot of effort way back in the day to make sure that,
yeah,
that the project that became the Hubble actually took place. So this telescope will be launched supposedly in 2025 if there are no further delays. And at that point, they're going to aim it. They're going to, among the things it's going to do, they're going to aim it at the sky. They're going to take the long exposure shots, same as Hubble did.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas Hubble, if it was a postage stamp in the sky, if that's the area of your survey, this is going to be 100 times greater than that. They're going to have at least 100 times more information to go with. And then they'll be able to come up with a more clearer analysis and likely be able to officially dismiss the large.
Now, with that new telescope, we might be able to see a sign that the quasars do want to be considered a collection, because it's really up to them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to disenfranchise the quasars, because we have to,
but
gravity can trump all of their beliefs.
That's true.
That's right.
All
so
right.
That's the update.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Bob, you're going to quickly tell us
about
on neutron stars.
Is that Manhattan Island? Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so researchers have refined their models suggesting that neutron star mountains are actually probably far smaller than we ever thought they were. And that fact could actually, this advance they made could actually help us detect them in the future. This was talked about at the National Astronomy Meeting 2021 in the UK. Now, mountains. I've been thinking about mountains a lot because I was researching mountains on neutron stars. Mm-hmm. We all know the biggest mountains. What's the biggest mountain on the Earth, guys?
Everest.
Actually, that's a vague question I just asked.
It depends on the base.
The Marianas Trench.
Right. So Everest is 88 meters, but that's sea level. You know, it's sea level above sea level. But then, did you ever hear of Mount Chimborazo's peak? Is actually the farthest point from the center of the Earth.
Oh.
And that's one way to say that's the tallest mountain,
right? That sounds
legit
to me.
It's the farthest away. But that's only 6,200 meters. But that, you know why it's so big, Steve? You might be able to guess why that's so big. It's so big it's at the equator. And the Earth is an oblate spheroid, so the poles are flattened, and so the equator's extended. So that's why that's so far away from the center. But then I think the real winner, the true tallest mountain on the Earth is Mauna Kea in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But you don't think of it as the biggest because its base is on the seafloor.
We only see
a tiny piece of it coming above the water. But it really is. That's 10,000 meters. That's over, almost 2,000 meters, 1,500 meters higher than Everest. Now, what's the highest mountain in the solar system?
Mons?
Yeah, Mars.
Olympus Mons. That's 25,000 meters.
Yeah,
that's huge. But, of course, there's reasons. It's a lower gravity. There's less erosion, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So then that made me think, all right, what's the biggest mountain that could ever exist on the Earth? What's the most?
On the Earth? 1G?
The biggest mountain is that could possibly exist is probably Mount Everest.
Yeah.
Which kind of surprised me. I was kind of disappointed. I was hoping that we could have a mountain that's 30,000 feet.
Is Everest continuing to rise, though?
But actually, but Everest is an anomaly. It's two crustal plates.
Yeah, they crash together.
Otherwise, it would never be that big. Because if it was just a regular crustal plate, it could never be. It could only be maybe 4,300 meters. So it's kind of interesting.
Did I show you this? I saw a video. I put this video on our Facebook page. They show you Mount Everest and they zoom out from a flat perspective of the Earth, and it shows you just how incredibly small it is compared to how big the Earth is.
Jeez.
Like Mount Everest is nothing compared to the size of the Earth.
True, but if you look at the mountains on a neutron star, it's even far greater.
Are there mountains on a neutron star?
So what's the tallest mountain on a neutron star? And a neutron star, I'm going to have to describe it real quick. I love describing it, even though I've done it a million times. A neutron star is a stellar corpse. It's not my favorite types of corpse, but it's the top three corpses that exist in my book anyway.
Wait, what are your favorite corpses?
Oh, no.
Don't have time.
Next month. October's coming, though.
October.
But neutron stars are huge. Imagine taking 1.5 to 2 stars of our sun and squishing them down to like 20 kilometers, about the size, as you see in the picture, as big as Manhattan. So this is a lot of mass in a very, very tiny space. We're talking 2 billion Earth gravities. 2
billion.
Whoa.
That it's inconceivable. A meatball on a neutron star would weigh over a billion tons. A billion tons. One meatball.
I couldn't lift it to my mouth.
Right? There you go. So gravity is so high on a
neutron. How high is it?
It's so high.
No, it's so high that they're near perfect spheres. Near perfect.
That's cool.
Now, you'll notice I said near perfect. It's kind of like
they're
mostly
only
dead.
There is no perfect.
You're almost there, but not quite. But it's those imperfections on the tiny imperfections on the surface of neutron star. That's where those mountains are. That's where the mountains live.
But you're calling these tiny imperfections mountains.
Yes, and I love that they call them mountains. I mean, they're so massive, but whatever. You know, some astronomer said we should call them hills. Like, no, call them mountains. Because they're so massive, Jay. I mean, they're not a mountain's worth of mass, but they're amazingly massive. But they really live on the crust. Neutron stars have crust. It's about a kilometer thick. This is like pure neutronium. Essentially, it's neutrons, all neutrons, all close together. Essentially, that's what this is. So it's amazingly strong. But you're having 2 billion Earth gravities on a neutron star. So even a crust can have problems. And so there's lots of strains that can happen on the crust. Things can happen like a neutron star can have these things called glitches where it speeds up in a weird anomalously, or there's strain from the electromagnetic fields are so intense that it causes strain on the crust, and the crusts can deform and cause these little deviations, these little kind of things on the surface. Those are the mountains that we're talking about because of the crust. Now, if you look at previous, how many minutes I got left? So if you look at previous research, not going to happen. If you look at previous research, they said these mountains are 10 centimeters tall. But that was actually a kind of a silly number because they were using Newtonian gravity, which was making some very odd assumptions. So they used relativistic gravity to assess it, and they found that it's not 10 centimeters. These mountains probably can't get any bigger than 1 centimeter or even 1 millimeter. So if you were a god striding on a neutron star, which is something I would do if I were a god, because that's an awesome bucket list item. So if you could expand the size of the neutron star as big as the Earth, the biggest mountain on a neutron star would be 1 centimeter. That's like a 5 meter bump on the Earth, 5 meters. Or if the mountain was a 1 millimeter, that's 19 inches. 19 inches would be the biggest thing on the entire surface of the Earth, you know, relatively speaking.
So
that tells you how close to perfection that neutron star may be
the most perfect sphere in the
It's
universe.
Close, but it's actually a good thing that it's not a perfect sphere, Jay, because of those tiny little imperfections, the neutron star will release gravitational waves.
Yeah.
Because if it was a perfect sphere spinning, we would never detect it using gravitational waves. Yeah. Because for gravitational waves to be emitted, you have to have mass distributions that are changing over time, which would not happen if you were perfect.
Yeah. That's fascinating, Bob. All right, let's move on.
It was so fascinating.
Let's move on to science or fiction.
That's pretty
much it. It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts,
okay.
2 real and 1 fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for
yes.
3
no.
news items?
No.
Here we go.
I've not
item
been
number
well
1. Astronomers report in a new study that super flares from young red dwarf stars are much less dangerous to their planets than previously thought. Item number 2. The first time a lithium-ion battery is charged, it permanently loses 10 to 18% of its capacity. But scientists present a new simple method that prevents 93% of this loss. And item 3, a new study involving bacteriophages Ooh. Details a potential new gene editing system more efficient and precise than CRISPR. Okay, I'm just
yes.
going to go from left to right here. Ian, our intelligent automated neural network is going to poll the chat.
Yes. So I've just added a new poll, everybody. So which one is the fiction? Go ahead and click there. Is it the red dwarf item, the lithium-ion battery?
But while we're doing that, Evan, go ahead and give me
yeah, we've got to hurry
give
up.
Me your answer.
Okay. Super flares from young red dwarf stars, much less dangerous to their planets than previously thought. Again, any of these could be the obvious answer.
That's the idea.
Okay, much less dangerous. I don't have a problem with that, going from more dangerous to less dangerous. You're more cautious in the beginning. You realize it's not as bad as you thought, so I'm okay there. First time the lithium-ion battery is charged, it permanently loses 10 to 18%? Permanently? Oh my gosh. But scientists present a new simple method that prevents 93% of this loss. 93% of 10 to 18%?
Yes. They're calling it their one simple trick.
Oh gosh. Yeah, I have a problem when it comes to these kinds of claims. You know, battery claims often fall short of their expected results or what people express that they can do. So I'm going to hold back on that one. And then the last one about the bacteriophages, detailing potential new. Oh boy, more efficient and precise than CRISPR. Okay, but is it a matter of scale? In other words, yes, it might be more. It is more efficient, more precise than CRISPR, but we can't really do much with it as far as we can't coax out of it like things to make our lives better. So I guess I'll go with safe, and I'll say it's the battery one that is the fiction, because more often than not it is.
All right, Jay.
So the last one about the bacteriophages being more precise than CRISPR, that one is making me think it might be the fiction. It just would be hard. It's hard for me to put into words after watching George Church talk yesterday. I wonder how much more precise things can be than the current CRISPR-9 technology. I believe the battery one. I believe it. I think that's true. So it's between CRISPR and the astronomers and superflares. I'm going to say that number one is the fiction because they call them superflares. And if they weren't that dangerous, they wouldn't be super.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, superflares. I suppose that's possible. Perhaps superflares don't happen as often as they thought, which then makes them less dangerous. If it doesn't happen that often, that's possible. But I think they're pretty dangerous. The lithium ion battery one, that one I thought for sure that's baloney, because that's almost 20% from the first charge, and not having that note, you know, read about that ever, you think that would have been out there, because that's huge. So I'm thinking that one might be the fiction, but then this, I'm having trouble with the bacteriophages. Bacteriophages, they are viruses that eat bacteria. Why do they need a gene editing tools? But for that reason, I think that might be the fiction.
All right, Kara, they're all over the place. No help to you.
We're scrambled here.
They're all spread out.
I think a bacteriophage. So why would a bacteriophage need gene editing? Well, that's what viruses do. They insert themselves into DNA. It's very common that they would cut DNA.
But they eat bacteria. Bacteriophage means eat bacteria, right? They eat it.
Bob, you're talking about it. Go ahead, Kara.
This one doesn't bother me, especially because of how it's worded. A potential new gene editing system that's more efficient and precise than CRISPR. So proof of concept, look at this cool thing they do. Maybe if we iterate, we'll be able to develop a new gene editing system. Totally believe that. So for me, it's always been between the red dwarf. Okay, are the super flares much less dangerous? If this were fiction, it would probably be that they're much more dangerous than previously thought. Then again, are they only dangerous if all of the aliens living on that planet have electronic devices that could be wiped out by the super flare? I don't know.
That's a good point.
And then the lithium ion battery permanently losing 10 to 18% of its capacity on a first charge. That sounds bizarre to me. And don't they usually say charge it fully? When you first get it, charge it all the way to the top. Would that be to prevent this kind of loss? I don't know. So I think I'm going to go with, I think, is it Evan on this one? Did you call the lithium ion one the fiction?
I called battery fiction.
I think I'm going to go with Evan on this one. I feel like this battery, maybe they permanently lose 2%. I don't know. That seems really high to me. So I'm going to go with Evan.
Okay. Ian, do we have a score from the chat?
We sure do. So they said the lithium ion battery is the fiction.
Damn.
With closely following by the red dwarf and then bacteriophages.
Most
true, perhaps.
Okay. All right. So I guess I'll take these in order since we're all spread out.
Damn.
We'll start with number one. Astronomers report in a new study that superflares from young red dwarf stars are much less dangerous to their planets than previous thought. Jay, you thought this was the fiction, correct?
I did.
This one is science.
I know.
There's a very interesting reason why this is science. I didn't think of it. Bob, you didn't think of it. It's not that they're less frequent. It's that
diffuse.
They're aimed towards the poles.
Not in the disk.
Yeah, so they're not. Not aimed at the planets. It's aimed
90 degrees away.
They looked at five different flares. They were all greater than 55 degrees away from the ecliptic of the, and the probability of that being random chance, if they were evenly distributed, was 1 in 1,000.
Uh-huh.
So it's not exactly ironclad evidence, but
that's
pretty strong evidence that they're more likely to occur towards the poles than the ecliptic, which means they would not be aimed at their planet. And of course, the problem with the superflares is that they scour the atmosphere away from them. It's not just that they're bad for electronic devices, they actually remove the atmosphere. So this,
it would hurt.
We've been back and forth on this. This actually goes back now, increasing the probability of life on planets around red dwarfs. All right, let's go to number two. The first time a lithium ion battery is charged, it permanently loses 10 to 18% of its capacity, but scientists present a new simple method that prevents 93% of this loss. Evan and Kara, you think this is fiction. The majority of the chat thinks this one is the fiction. And this one is science.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Baby.
Good job. Yeah.
No.
This one is done in by a battery.
The reason why this happens is because there are impurities in the battery, and those impurities will bind to the lithium the very first time you charge it, permanently removing them from the battery cycle. And so what they figured out was just a chemical change to one of the anode or the cathode, I forget which one, and that prevents this from happening, 93%. So it prevents 93% of this of these impurities from binding up with the lithium.
That's great.
So this is great. I mean, imagine
that's
that
great.
This. And they say they should be able to slip this into the production stream without any problem. This doesn't require any retooling or anything. And so if this all pans out, this could be on average, a 15% or so, or 12% increase in capacity of lithium ion batteries.
That's bad.
That's not bad.
Steve, you're so good at this.
What about the next one now, Steve?
You got us all. I mean, Bob's the only one in only what percentage of the poles?
The least.
The least amount of people.
All right.
No, the red dwarf, right? It was a...
A new study involving bacteriophages details a potential new gene editing system more efficient and precise than CRISPR. This one is the fiction. What they did find was just a new Cas payload. It's still CRISPR, but instead of CRISPR Cas9, it's CRISPR Cas
14?
13, I think.
That means it's better.
12J.
CRISPR Cas 12J.
Yeah,
so yes, bacteriophages.
I want it to be better.
Kara, bacteriophages, they need an immune system too. So they need to be able to edit genes and protect themselves, et cetera. So anyway, so this is just another incremental advance in the CRISPR system, but it's not a replacement of the CRISPR system.
Okay.
Not that there won't be something out there like that, but that would have been much bigger news. This is just more of an incremental
advance. Good job, Steve.
Advance. Good job, Bob.
Tough. Thank you.
So that is, that's it for Science or Fiction. Evan, we just have enough time for a skeptical quote of the week.
Humanity has the stars in its future, and that future is too important to be lost under the burden of juvenile folly and ignorant superstition. Isaac Asimov.
Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of reading the Foundation series, Asimov is a great writer. Interesting. Maybe we'll talk about it some more sometime. Very interesting. But yeah, I like how this incorporates the positive, and also with, yes, but we can't fall for superstition. It's kind of what we do as skeptics. We're positive about science. This conference is positive. But yes, we still have to remember that we can't fall for silly superstitions. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me.
You got it, man.
Thanks, great show, guys.
George, thank you for hosting Nexus.
Thanks
to Ian. Thanks to everybody who's helping behind the scenes. Thanks to all the audience for joining us. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.